Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Last year, the La Crosse County Board began to seriously consider the future of its current downtown administrative center. Committees formed to weigh the options. Was it cheaper to undergo much-needed building repairs? Should the county construct a new building to house its many offices? Or were there existing locations that workers could move into? Last week, county board members voted to purchase a downtown bank and eventually make the building its new administrative center. Although the decision received most of the board's support, there are still many questions and deals to finalize before this becomes a reality. Here to talk about the future County Administrative Center are Tara Johnson, La Crosse County Board Chair, and Joe Veenstra, a La Crosse County Board Supervisor and Chair of the Administrative Center and Downtown Campus Study Committee. I'm wondering if first we can go back a few months, maybe even years, and talk about why it is that the county decided that it needed to get out of its current administrative center.
When they constructed the building, they sprayed the building with fireproofing that contained asbestos on the columns, much of the structure, supporting structure. And they also utilized a cold air plenum return system for the heating and ventilation. That gets us to where we are today. And that is that we have a building that is laden, unfortunately, with friable asbestos and an HVAC cold air return system, which makes continued occupancy of the building risky.
So why was it that the county board decided that it may not be the most feasible option to just clean up the asbestos and deal with it?
We were exploring all options. One of those was to completely gut the building. We had a couple different ideas for that, one of which was to just gut the building and remodel the building in its existing structure. That expense for just the asbestos removal was upwards of $2 million. And there was another plan, which was to take off the old, what people now call the women's jail, but they call it Section B of the administrative center, the architects did, to take that off and sort of construct a new point of entry area. So those were the two options we looked at with regard to the current building.
We know that we are currently not using all of the space in the building, so it's got roughly 120,000 square feet. We use ballpark figures here, about 80,000 square feet. And so one of the issues was thinking about the larger footprint than we need, dynamic of it. And we also, early on, Joe's committee really wanted help in thinking about what might we do with this space. And so they let out a request for proposal to the community, had 9 groups walk through, look at the building, think about what they might do with it, and received back an offer from Borton 360 to repurpose the building and turn it into student housing for primarily the Western student population. But that process really kind of helped us think about what else might be done with that space, and then further kind of set things in motion in looking at lots of different options for the space that the county might use, understanding we needed a smaller footprint actually than we were taking up.
Yeah, one of the things we did was we had the architect do a space needs analysis. River Architects was who won that process. That was bid, and they won it. I think they were one of the lowest cost, and we had prior experience with them working in the law enforcement center. But they did a space needs analysis. It was a comprehensive analysis, talking to all department heads, analyzing the square footage needs that they had, trying to figure out what sort of things could be combined with conference rooms and such.
The administrative building was originally built as a courthouse. So there are, you know, wide hallways and then rooms off to either side. So there's a lot of wasted space in those hallways. And when River Architects looked at the space analysis that Joe was talking about, we also asked them to look at adjacency issues. And the example that I like to share is somebody who's building a home and needing to drill a well and have a zoning permit and have land conservation work with them on an erosion control plan. And right now, they have to go to three different places and go into three different doors and three different offices to get all those permits? And are there ways that we could, in either in the current building or now in the Associated Bank building, are there ways that we can configure that space and move departments around so that there is adjacency that provides not only efficiency for staff and maybe use less space, but also make it much more user-friendly for the public? Can you come into one reception area and get several different services at that one counter?
Joe, did you want to add anything?
One of the things that we're likely to have happen, no matter what happens with this whole thing, is, for example, Corporation Counsel's office, the attorneys for the county, and also child support, that department are likely to move into the courthouse, law enforcement center, because their work makes more sense there.
So since these discussions really began, there have been a lot of options thrown out there. And the most recent development, which seems like it may be a reality, is that the administrative center offices would move into, or at least most of them, would move into the Associated Bank building on the 600 block of State Street. How did this option come about?
It was kind of fluky, and it did, admittedly, came late in the game, in the decision-making process for giving Borton 360 or Stizzo the answer that they had requested on their offer to purchase our building. So they made that offer back in July, I believe it was, and we have known all along that we had a January deadline to respond to that offer from them. So it was late in the decision-making game for that. We knew that Associated Bank was looking to sell their administrative services building on La Crosse Street and just kind of had heard people who were interested in looking at that building. Some people asked us if we had looked at that building. It's not big enough. It's, you know, it's maybe 15,000 square feet or so. But that led to talking with Associated Bank, which led to we've got a bank building and it's too big for them. They're looking to reduce their footprint in La Crosse, maintain a presence, but in a much smaller footprint. So it was kind of a fluky way that we found out about it.
And is it the right size for the county administrative center?
It's close.
You know, their building wasn't on the market. I think what I've told many, many people is, one, we did not want to have this problem in our lap to begin with. Two, we didn't plan for this option to become available as late in the process as it did. So we had to work extremely diligently, quickly, while keeping the people involved in our committee informed and maintaining confidentiality that the bank wanted, because they didn't want they just didn't want this to become public if it wasn't a potential reality. So it was just a very rapid but thorough process of analysis.
And the cost of the building?
Well, we're still in negotiations. We got an analysis and an appraisal that came in at $4.6 million, and that is our offer. That includes a building at $4 million and all the related parking and parking across the street for $600,000.
Is that parking across the street, is that owned by Western Technical College?
No, it's owned by the bank.
That's owned by the bank.
I think
okay.
Western maybe has been using it.
Okay. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the new La Crosse County Administrative Center. My guests are Joe Veenstra, a La Crosse County Board Supervisor and Chair of the Administrative Center and Downtown Campus Study Committee, and Tara Johnson, the La Crosse County Board Chair. So in order for this move to happen into the now Associated Bank building, there are a lot of other pieces that need to fall into place. First, let's talk about the sale of the current administrative center to 360 and Borton Construction. As you talked about earlier, they want to potentially make that student housing, but they need a decision by January. Why is it that they needed a decision so quickly?
Well, they made the offer back in July, and what's critical for the Stizzo folks, which is the partnership that's been formed between Borton and 360, is that they have construction complete in that building to accommodate students moving in to Western late summer, July or August of a year. Doesn't help them much to have that building ready in March or April of a year. So in the offer that they made to us, they projected out their student move-in date.
Which is still
in that
few
building.
Years out from here.
Right. So what we're operating under now is that move-in would happen in July or August of 2017, and working back from that, the time that they need for construction, the time that we need to get out of the building, the time that they need for asbestos abatement and that whole project. It really is triggered off of the student move-in date, you know, late summer time frame, and working back on those construction and move timetables that both of us need.
And they've offered to pay $250,000 for the current administrative center?
Right. That's the offer. Yes, that's the price. In fact, I signed the offer before I came over here. So we've accepted their offer with a purchase price of $250,000.
Is that a good deal for them? Is that enough to cover some of the costs for the county?
I think if you were just a layperson walking by the building, you might say $250,000, you know, that's not enough.
You buy a nice house in La Crosse for
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. However, we put it out to the market. You know, if you believe in the free market, that's what we did. And we got one offer. The reason being asbestos and other repairs that are necessary in the building. If you walk through that building, which I did, you will find a lot of things that need work, exterior, all the systems in the building need upgrading. It's not really modern and from a sustainability sense. The STIZO proposal was to do the same thing that our proposal would have done, which is gut the building completely, because the asbestos experts said the most long-term cost savings viable thing to do was remove all the asbestos and start anew with just the envelope. That's what their proposal does. It's what we got. We would have had to spend that money as well to remove the asbestos and to do the remodeling. So it's a market-driven price. And it's also consistent with, you know, La Crosse County and the city of La Crosse are both, you know, have signed on with sustainability practices, which is reuse. You know, that's tearing down the building is not an environmentally sound practice. They are proposing to reuse the building for a purpose that's beneficial to the community. We thought it was a good collaborative concept with TC. The options that we had available, maintained campus unity, which was a primary goal that we had. You know, would I say it's some, you know, golden egg? No, but it's what the market-driven approach got us.
There also have been questions raised about if we were to stay in the building, we would have to abate the asbestos, as Joe said. We'd have to do significant remodeling. We'd have more space than we needed in that envelope, the new envelope. And we would have to do that in a staged way. You know,
people can keep working.
Right. We have to make sure that the services to the public continue every day that the offices are open. And to do abatement of asbestos is much more expensive in a building like the administrative center, piece by piece. If you can take everybody out and seal off the building and take all the precautionary measures that are necessary to abate the asbestos and do that encapsulated at one time, it's less expensive than if you're trying to encapsulate a floor at a time or a portion of the building at a time and do that abatement. And then you're moving offices multiple times. And so there's expense involved in that. There's disruption of service involved in that. There aren't any simple answers to just, you know, take a couple years and move everybody out, make the building what you want it to be, and then move everybody back in.
Another part of this puzzle is moving Associated Bank from the 600 block of State Street. And one of the things that it seems like the administration is interested in is building their new bank in County Parking Lot C downtown.
In talking with Associated, that is a contingency of the sale of their
so
building.
So it would have to happen.
Right. It would have to happen. They're talking about a 12,000 square foot retail outlet. Part of our discussion with them was that we wanted, if there's going to be a bank on Lot C, we want it to be consistent with our development plans for Lot C and work with those development plans. And in principle, they've agreed that that's what they want too. They don't want, you know, to have some poor location that isn't a nice development on Lot C. They want to have work with us in that regard. You know, devil's in the details. We're just being in the process of that. But those are contingencies that we will insist on. One of their contingencies is that they have a space on Lot C.
And when you talk about your development plans, does this go back to the study conducted a few months ago that said, you know, if the county offices were to move there, and maybe it's still like now, if the bank, when the bank moves there, that it should also support some sort of business development within that lot?
Right. All along the – so Joe's headed up this committee that we've called Administrative Center and Downtown Campus Study Committee. And Lot C has always been part of that conversation. And maybe we should just mention that Lot C, maybe for listeners, is more recognizable as the Farmers Market Saturday morning parking lot or the old Courthouse Square, which is what it was, you know, a couple generations ago. So that lot has always been part of what – you know, the county owns it and part of what we wanted – Joe's committee to be looking at. And so we will, in the next 60 days, in February and March, in a pretty intense way, work with a number of community leaders and neighbors of ours to resolve some questions about what does the density look like on Lot C as it gets developed? What are the sustainable practices that have to be incorporated in whatever development we do? What kind of shared parking might be available? Mixed use? What look to that lot does the public really want to see? So those are kind of the broader parameters that we will be establishing with the advisory committee so that when we let out the request for proposal to solicit development ideas, those responses are consistent with what the community is asking for. The hope is that that redevelopment or the development plan for Lot C gives enough flexibility so that there is a spot for Associated Bank to be in the new footprint that they want to have on that lot that is consistent with their needs and what they want to use space for downtown.
Our discussions with them have always included that as one of the principal bases for allowing that. I mean, if it was going to be something that interfered with the development of Lot C, the creation of as maximum tax base as we can get on Lot C, we probably wouldn't do it. I mean, and that still is a possibility. If the RFPs come back and we are not happy, if we don't think that's some maximum utility for that lot, that's a contingency of our offer to purchase that, and it's also a contingency of the Stizzo Borton 360 purchase of our building is that we close on Associated. So there's all these dominoes that have to fall. We have created enough contingencies so that the county and that our taxpayers are protected, but we still want to work with – we're negotiating in good faith. We want to maximize the density and tax base on Lot C and create a jewel for La Crosse County, one that's consistent with the historical downtown, but also modernizes and also creates a vision that all of us could be proud of.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the future of the La Crosse County Administrative Center. My guests are Joe Veenstra, a La Crosse County Board Supervisor and Chair of the Administrative Center and Downtown Campus Study Committee, and Tara Johnson. She's a La Crosse County Board Chair.
So that Lot C is basically considered the final piece of prime real estate in downtown La Crosse.
Yep.
In a way, could Associated Bank be getting a deal?
They're interested in owning their own property, and they don't want to own the whole lot is what we know from them right now. We hope to give kind of shape through the advisory committee process – give shape to what that lot will look like. And what we hope happens is that the associated footprint that they are interested in having can, you know, fit with the larger development of that lot.
And you'll sell that land off to Associated and then any other development that goes on there?
Right. That's correct. Okay. That's the idea.
It's not like them leasing county.
Right. Okay. No, they want to own it.
The county has retained an expert in development projects like this to help us through this process and also to do site assessments and things like that. And we all along have utilized their expertise. At the beginning, we were thinking we might want to locate on Lot C. And they said we could locate on Lot C, and they still think that there could be private development on Lot C that would give us tax base. But the county board seemed to react, and I think it was fair in a way that we didn't want to do anything that might inhibit development of Lot C. So we took that in our committee. Our recommendation did not include that. We also contacted the expert when this idea came up in our discussions with Associated and said, would the sale of a portion of Lot C inhibit our goals with regard to an RFP for complete development of Lot C? And our expert told us that they believed that it might actually enhance it. So, you know, we are hopeful for that too. We want to maximize any recovery for the county while maintaining a good lot C development.
And some supervisors have been critical in saying that the decision, especially when it comes to lot C, may be moving too quickly. Do you have enough time to decide the future of this because it is such an important piece of land?
I definitely think we do. The experts that Joe's been talking about are Stantec. We're right now mapping out about a 60-day time frame for that visioning and the advisory group's work. And he absolutely is very confident we can do it in that time. Would 90 days be better? Maybe. But the reality for us is that we have this, you know, as you kind of described it, I like to talk about it as, you know, the old 15 puzzle that you used to do as a kid where you had to move all the numerals around and get them lined up in order. A lot of things have to fall into place correctly for all of this to work. But I've been recruiting people to serve on this advisory committee, and everyone who I've asked has said yes. They are anxious to be involved in it. They understand the 60-day time frame. They're very comfortable with that. The folks at Stantec, our consultants on this, are very comfortable with the 60 days. And I think it is absolutely enough time. There will be more time then when the requests for proposals come back and people can look at those, and the county board will have time to, you know, to look at those as well. You know, really what's setting all of this off is that we need to act on moving out of the administrative center. And the offer that we have, that we have accepted, is to repurpose that building into student housing. And so that clock is ticking also to get the renovation and the moving done so that students can move into that housing. This year alone, there were over 300 students on a waiting list for housing at Western. And so I think it's important to understand that, yes, there are a lot of moving parts, and the timeline sometimes might feel a bit rushed, but Joe's committee has done amazing work in being very open and really diligently looking at all of the options and reviewing them, and they have been moving at a pretty rapid pace all along.
There's a couple misperceptions, I think, in the public that I'd like to address. One is that we don't have to do anything, and that's just false. This is part of the history that I talked about. What they started to repair the roof of that building, I believe it was in 1984. Okay, so that was a little while ago. And there was an order that was issued by the judges at the time who were occupying the building to stop because the vibration on the roof was causing asbestos to essentially enter the airspace in the courtrooms. So they issued an order to stop that work. There has been work to cover the roof since then, but it hasn't really been repaired effectively. And I have a report here from 2004. So this is almost 10 years ago. And the recommendation in this report is, it is recommended to abate, and in case you didn't know what abate meant, he put in parentheses, remove all structural steel fireproofing materials and related overspray from all surfaces in this building as soon as feasible. So 10 years, mm-hmm. you know, might have been enough time to equal as soon as feasible. And one thing people don't realize, I saw somebody said, oh, you should just take some water and Elmer's glue and, you know, spray that on the asbestos and cover it with duct tape. Yeah, and it'll be fine. You know, I don't know where people get some of these ideas about what we can do, but we can't do that. The cost of actually trying to abate the asbestos by encapsulating, which is one of the other options, wouldn't eliminate the problem completely and cost 80% of what it costs to completely abate it. So you want to spend $1.8 million to still have a problem? I don't think so. We want to do the right thing. The right thing has been recommended for 10 years. The way it was described at our county board meeting was, do we kick the can down the road again? No. I mean, at some point you have to take responsibility and do the right thing. By accepting the RFP from what's now called STIZO, they're a private developer, okay? If they thought it was cost-effective to do nothing, their proposal will include doing nothing. If they thought it was cost-effective to encapsulate the asbestos, their proposal would have included encapsulation. Their proposal included complete abatement of the asbestos. So the reality is we had no choice.
So after all the moving parts and various payments. When all said and done, how much will La Crosse County be paying for this new building?
The purchase of Associated Bank and its remodeling, and because the Associated Bank building does not have enough square footage to meet the 80,000 approximate square feet that we need, there would have to be some new construction. Where that would occur, we're not exactly, we don't have any decision on that yet. The total is about a little over $19 million, and that would be paid for through debt service. The other options, which were the complete abatement of the existing county building, was about almost $24 million. And the other option, which was building entirely on the human services parking lot, was about $20 million as well. It was the least expensive option. And what I guess I described it as a deal breaker or a deal maker for me was this option, because of the parking addition to our parking needs, takes our needs off of Lot C, which is enhances the viability of private development on Lot C. It makes it a better lot for private development. So to me, that makes Scheme E, I think, by far the best option.
I think it's also important to note that the current administrative center, which is generating no tax revenue, will be converted to student housing, and that will go back onto the tax rolls. And that is projected at about $6.8 million in value that will be assessed and taxes generated from that. The Associated Bank building is appraised at this, all of those properties at 4.6. That's generating tax revenue right now, so that will be taken off of the tax rolls. But Lot C, which is an entire square block in prime real estate, as you said, Maureen, is currently a surface parking lot, which is generating no tax revenue and is really in all understanding of any kind of development, is the lowest, worst use of property in an urban area. And it is generating nothing right now and has the potential, from what we hear from our experts at Stantec, the folks who have helped us with this process so far, very easily, you know, over 8, 10, you know, depending on how dense we get, 12 even more million dollars worth of taxable property that would go back under the tax rolls. So that's part of this equation also, is looking at, you know, what's the net sum gain of all of this acquisition and transfer of property. And it is generating millions and millions of, has the potential to generate millions and millions of additional taxable property in the city of La Crosse. And I think that's really important for people to know as well.
Joe Veenstra is a La Crosse County Board Supervisor and Chair of the Administrative Center and Downtown Campus Study Committee. And Tara Johnson is La Crosse County Board's Chair. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we are talking about the future of the La Crosse County Administrative Center. Coming up next, we'll talk about the newest renewable project in Dairyland Power Cooperative's portfolio, solar power. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you can find archived shows and photos. Newsmakers is also on Facebook, like us at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Dairyland Power Cooperative, based in La Crosse, is adding more solar power to its renewable energy portfolio. Late last week, the company announced plans to buy solar power from a company known as Minnesota 3, which is building a new solar power transmission facility north of Rochester, Minnesota. The amount of solar power Dairyland is buying could be enough to power 60 homes. Joining us to talk about the project are Dairyland Vice President of External and Member Relations, Brian Rood, and Craig Harms. He's Dairyland's Manager of Business Development. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Craig how the Minnesota solar project came together.
Dairyland saw the need to expand and complement its renewables with a large solar project. We're particularly interested in the advantages of solar.
How does this project compare with the other solar projects that Deerland has?
We have a couple of projects that have contracts directly with Deerland Power. One is with the city of Galena, Illinois. They have a wastewater treatment plant down there, which is powered in part by 368 kW worth of solar panels. And then we also have a contract with the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge over in Juneau County. And they have a smaller array of about 68 kW there and sell the power to Deerland. We also have a number of smaller customer-owned solar facilities that are on homes and farms and businesses that are interconnected to our distribution cooperatives out there. And we're seeing some significant growth in the number of those systems out there.
How many homes do you have now?
Farms, homes, and businesses, we probably have approaching 350 of those facilities out there interconnected to our member cooperatives.
Does solar lend itself to more of the private homeowner getting involved?
I think the attraction of solar by the homeowner is the opportunity to generate their own, some of their own power and not have a lot of maintenance or operation issues. They're basically, they put them up and they run, and that's the attraction to them.
I do think we're going to see a trend, and a couple of our distribution cooperatives are exploring the idea of like a solar garden where individual members could buy a panel that was part of a broader project. And one of the advantages of the more commercial style projects is, frankly, they're more technically efficient. They tend to move with the sun. If you're going to put a panel on your roof, you're stuck with one direction. And if you can do a broader project, you get the advantages of having it move with the sun. You also have some safety and reliability issues that are addressed in a very positive way. So I think Deerland and some of our member cooperatives, as well as other utilities, are looking at things like so-called solar garden, where we bring a number of small solar users together in one location.
Yeah, and another advantage of the community solar concept is it allows homeowners or business owners that don't have a good solar window, or maybe the covenants don't allow them to put in solar, or maybe they're a renter. So this allows them to take advantage of the solar opportunity without having issues with their own property.
Could one of you talk about Minnesota 3? It's my understanding that it's a conglomeration of power companies that you're already working with.
And this is the contract that we just announced for a larger scale solar facility that will be located in Orinoco, Minnesota, just off Highway 52. Minnesota 3 will be the owner and developer of the project. Minnesota 3 is a limited liability corporation, three of our member distribution cooperatives, Freeborn Mauer Cooperative Services out of Albert Lea, People's Energy Cooperative located there at Orinoco, and then Tri-County Electric Cooperative in Rushford, Minnesota.
And how much power is going to be produced, and is Deerland buying all of it?
Yes, Deerland will be purchasing all of the output of the 517 kW array, which will take up about 2 to 3 acres of property and will generate somewhere around 680,000 kilowatt hours a year. That is the equivalent of the energy usage of about 60 homes on an annual basis.
Not a lot, but is that the typical solar project?
I think we will certainly see more of these going forward. A facility of this scale is certainly an exception in the Midwest here.
And I should just mention that our other renewable resources are much larger. For example, we have a biomass facility down at Cassville. That's a 40-megawatt facility. Now, that would serve about 2,400 homes, I guess.
And be 80 times the size of this.
80 times, yeah, so, or 24,000 homes. Yeah. We also have wind, and we have manure digesters and landfill gas and hydro. So altogether, Darylin's renewable portfolio now is about 12.5% of our sales. When I came to Darylin in 2000, we were under 1% renewable. So we've really made a sizable investment in that direction. And that's driven by public policy. Both Wisconsin and Minnesota have renewable portfolio standards. It's also driven, frankly, by our members. As Craig said, a lot of our members are supportive, want to do their part, want renewables. We have an evergreen program, which Craig runs. People can voluntarily contribute additional amounts on their power bill if they want to see more renewables built even faster.
88%, I guess, comes from largely from coal, natural gas.
Correct. Quite a bit from our own three major coal facilities. Also, we have a natural gas facility up by Eau Claire. And then we're on the marketplace of buying a lot of energy, and a lot of that comes from natural gas because that's kind of on the margin, and natural gas plants kick in when the market is right and the demands are higher.
You mentioned the state bar for renewables, and you're at or above where the state wants you to be.
Wisconsin's mandate is 10% by 2015. As I mentioned, we're at 12.5%. Mm-hmm. So we were honored last year by the Public Service Commission saying that Darylin had, of all the utilities in Wisconsin, had been the most aggressive at meeting that mandate. So that was good recognition. In Minnesota, the law is 25% renewable by 2025. And we do have those three Minnesota cooperatives. And so there we're required to achieve that 25%. amount. And we're on track for that, too. I think where we're at right now at 12.5% or so, 12 to 13% this year it'll be, that's pretty good on track for 2025.
Wisconsin has downgraded its mandates because I thought there was a goal of 25% by...
It's never been a mandate statutorily.
Okay.
It's always 10 has been the most... has been the law in Wisconsin. There's been talk of a 25 by 25, and actually Darylin has a members' resolution that our members are promoting a goal of 25 by 25 for our whole system. Right now in Wisconsin, it's 10%. There was an effort in the legislature this year to actually repeal the 10% mandate.
Right.
That failed, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Are most utilities in Wisconsin near that 10% right now?
All of them are basically at 10% except for We Energies, which is in Milwaukee. That's the state's largest utility.
Yeah.
I think the most recent thing I saw was about 8.5%. There are a couple things for We Energies. One is their immense size, of course. You know, they serve Milwaukee, most of southeast Wisconsin. And then secondly, they're at a bit of a disadvantage at building renewable resources given their geography. You know, for Xcel, for Darylin, for Alliant, we're in the western part of the state where we have pretty good opportunities at wind resources, and We Energies is having a more difficult time.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with Darylin Power Cooperative about solar energy today. Brian Rood is Darylin Cooperative's Vice President of External and Member Relations. Craig Harms is Manager of Business Development for Darylin Power. The company recently announced plans to buy solar energy from a new solar power generating plant north of Rochester, Minnesota. Craig, you had mentioned that you think solar is going to take off in the upper Midwest. It seems that solar power, while a lot of people like it, of the renewables that we see in the upper Midwest, solar is one of the least used. Is there a reason for that?
Certainly, the cost for solar has come down considerably. And when I said it's taking off, it has already begun to take off because of those costs coming down and because there are some very attractive incentives available through state and federal government.
So, but it's still the highest price form of renewable energy that's out there. And, for example, wind is probably a third or a fourth of the cost of solar for kilowatt per kilowatt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the attractiveness, particularly utility scale, wind tends to be the choice because it's so much cheaper and, frankly, probably a little more reliable. You know, the biggest issue, I think, with solar is the reliability issue. And even for the residential user, they really have to depend on being on the grid for the times when the sun doesn't shine. And, of course, it's particularly telling this time of the year. In July and August, solar probably does the trick. But, you know, on December the 21st, when it's 20 below, solar is a really bad choice because the sun doesn't shine very much in December in Wisconsin. And if we weren't there as a backup, people would be – solar couldn't do it alone.
Certainly a disadvantage of solar is its intermittent output. Night, of course, and then clouds and light intensity.
It's much more popular out west, is it not, in the southwestern part of the country as opposed to the upper Midwest?
Yes, and, you know, I've mentioned the disadvantage of solar, but an advantage of solar is it's on peak, and that's generally when we have more demand for energy. So that's a very strong positive. And you talk about the southwest, a lot more solar down there, but I think people are seeing that there are opportunities for solar in the Midwest, and that's why we're seeing such a growth here.
Define that term on peak that you used.
Sure. On peak would be the daytime hours during the week, particularly when businesses are operating and people are washing their clothes and cooking dinner, and that's when the most power is used by farms, homes, and businesses.
Yeah. And as I said, in the summer in particular, it really follows the peak because our peak hours on our system in the summer probably are 3 to 8 p.m., and that's a time when the sun is shining. Mm-hmm. Now, in the winter, when our peak is 3 to 8 p.m., solar isn't as good a choice.
But. Right. I know that Deerland is a power in the Campex 2020 project. Does this project play into that at all?
I don't think it plays into the solar because solar is so small yet at this point, but it definitely plays into wind. I mean, a major driving factor in the whole CapEx 2020 project in Minnesota is the fact that Minnesota has such valuable wind resources, especially on the so-called Buffalo Ridge, which is kind of in that Austin-Albert Lea area. And the transmission system that was in place there did not have any way of moving that energy to the larger cities, the Twin Cities, even here in La Crosse. So as we look at the CapEx project, really the two biggest drivers of that project were delivering renewable energy from western Minnesota, the Dakotas, to the east, and then secondly, local reliability. You know, particularly Rochester, for example, which has had phenomenal growth and not much transmission infrastructure built. I think the city's grown by tens of thousands of people in the last 20 years. And so it's those two components that have really driven that CapEx 2020 project.
And we should define CapEx 2020.
CapEx 2020 actually is a Minnesota initiative. There are seven transmission lines in Minnesota that I think were originally proposed. The one we're talking about, the one we're most familiar with, would go from south of the Twin Cities down to Rochester, cross the Mississippi River at Alma, and then come to La Crosse. And it's designed, as I said, for reliability in our region, Rochester, La Crosse, along the river. It's also designed to bring some of that renewable energy. It is not part of the Badger Cooley project, which is another different proposal to move from La Crosse to Madison.
Mm-hmm. But having a more renewable portfolio will be more appealing, for example, the Public Service Commission in Wisconsin, won't it?
Yeah, no question about it. Everybody wants more renewables, and to the extent you're putting in wind in particular, you need a way to move that and to meet the standards, but also just to meet customer need. And as I mentioned, right now wind is very cheap compared to some of the other renewable resources. The price of wind has really come down, and it's competitive with coal. Wind, like solar, does have the intermittent issue. The capacity factor of most of our wind is 35% of the time you're getting energy, or 35% of the capacity. So it's still not as reliable as natural gas or coal, but it's a major player in the energy picture in the Midwest.
I know a lot of people who are opposed to CapEx 2020 say do a better job with renewables and that type of thing, but the current transmission system does not always allow for that. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Doesn't allow for importing the larger wind volume that's coming
and
from the west.
Will this project, CapEx 2020, the Badger Gully project, will it allow for that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's going to expand the capacity considerably coming from the west. So there are a couple kinds of opposition to the CapEx project and to Badger Coulee as well. One is you always have some of the not in my backyard. Nobody likes a transmission line in their backyard. And so we understand that, and we have to deal with that every day. But the other issue is one of system reliability and safety of the system. It's true that on most days we have more transmission infrastructure than we need, but we don't build for most days. We have to build for peak days. And the system is very constrained in this region for those peak days. As I mentioned, Rochester has had phenomenal growth. La Crosse has grown pretty well. So we have to build the system for the peak days, the hottest days of the year, the coldest days of the year. And we're pushing that and pushing the reliability. And not only is it important that we have the energy on those days, because they are the hottest and the coldest, it would be catastrophic if we failed on those days. So I think the difference is that some of the opponents say, well, let's just build more small renewables throughout the region, and then we won't need transmission lines. We have to keep the reliability of the whole system. And, you know, we have a different mission there in that we have to be sure that all 235,000 of our customers, which represents about 600,000 people, will be able to turn their heat or their air conditioning on in that hot day of the year or the coldest day of the year.
What does the future of solar power look like in general for Dairyland Power?
We're seeing more customers put solar generation on, and certainly we're going to be looking at the performance, the operation of the Minnesota 3 project, and we'll be evaluating the reliability and maintenance needs and operation, and we'll probably determine from there where we go with further solar projects.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about solar, this project, or the other projects you have going on?
Just that with the Minnesota 3 project, as Brian mentioned, you know, this is going to be a customer or a member-owned project because our members own the distribution cooperatives. They own us as cooperatives. So we're excited that this is going to be owned by the member.
There's a lot of emphasis these days on solar and wind. They're visible. They're talked about a lot. I think the other renewable resources, particularly in the biomass area, have a lot of potential and promise for Wisconsin and for the region. We do have some digesters on our system. We think they're, you know, a great answer to waste management issues. Operationally, they've been kind of challenging because it's a more difficult project. But I think the future, you're going to see a lot more biomass projects utilizing waste products. We just did our first project with Bush Bean up by
Bush Brothers Beans, the bean makers,
yeah,
in Augusta, Wisconsin.
Augusta, mm-hmm. And we have a digester there with their byproducts, and so with, you know, Wisconsin being heavy in timber agriculture, food products. I think the future of biomass is one that you're going to see a lot more attention on in Wisconsin.
Brian Rood is Vice President of External and Member Relations, and Craig Harms is Business Development Manager for Dairyland Power Cooperative, based in La Crosse. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about a new partnership to buy electricity from a new solar-powered transmission facility north of Rochester, Minnesota. The project is expected to start generating power this June. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos. And if you'd like to comment on our program, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.